You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Thomas E. Ricks is the senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post and a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for national reporting. In his over two decades of journalism, he's written three books on the U.S. military, and his newest one is called Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's published by Penguin Press, and it brings Thomas E. Ricks to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
The word usually applied to Iraq by critics is quagmire, but you've chosen fiasco, which strikes me as much more damning. When did you decide that the situation you were describing was a fiasco?
I began to suspect it a couple of years ago. It was in the spring of 2004 when the Shiite militias started erupting in addition to the Sunni insurgency, and I was in a convoy that was making its way across southwestern area past Baghdad. And we had bridges blown up in front of us, and then ultimately, as we crossed the Euphrates River, we were bombed and machine gunned, and one soldier was killed, two were wounded. And I woke up the next morning, and I thought the word fiasco sort of appeared in my head.
You've also called the war one of the most profligate actions in the history of American foreign policy. Do you have any others to compare it with? The one people mostly compare it with is Vietnam, but I've always wondered whether that isn't kind of apples and oranges.
There are similarities to Vietnam, but I think actually there are probably more similarities to the French experience in Algeria. I don't quite say it's the biggest mistake in U.S. foreign policy, the history of U.S. foreign policy. There are other big mistakes. The loss of Eastern Europe to the Soviet Union after World War II, I think, is clearly a much bigger mistake. I mean profligate in the sense that also there was an element of choice here. We didn't have to invade Iraq. We didn't have to invade at the time we did, nor did we have to occupy it negligently. So the recklessness of the decision is kind of what I tried to capture in that word profligate in the first sentence of the book.
Well, let's talk about occupying it negligently, as you said. Did the military and civilian leadership expect to face an insurgency of this kind when they started preparing for this war?
They didn't. And this is one of the most crushing things about the experience to me, is that there really was no plan B. There was an insistence from the top on rosy scenarios, on basing planning on extremely optimistic assumptions. You'd hear the cliche out of military leaders and out of civilian leaders like Paul Wolfowitz. Oh, of course, they'd say no plan survives its first contact with reality. But what military planners also do is they have a plan B ready. What if our assumptions aren't right? What if things go differently? And they never really seem to have that.
Well, weren't they warned, as I understand it, in fact, you talk about it in your book, academics and exiles and military experts were all called in to talk about what they might expect, and then all of that was just ignored.
It was ignored at the time, and there's this sort of myth that has kind of been cultivated lately that everybody thought like we thought going in, and the simple fact is that's not true. People often accuse the Bush administration of lying about everything, and I disagree with that. I think they really did believe, for example, that there were weapons of mass destruction. On a manipulative reading of intelligence, they had come to believe that. But I think they really did believe it. But I think in that area, they really are skating on very thin ice when they say everybody believe what we believe. No, they didn't. There were a lot of warnings, a lot of studies that were ignored. And this is one of the problems you had in going to the war in the way they did. In most wars, you broaden your base as you go to war. You bring in people who might be neutral. FDR, for example, as president, brought in Henry Stimson to be his Secretary of War, a former Republican Secretary of War. In this case, you had a steady narrowing in which people who disagreed were not invited back to the next meeting. So in the book, for example, I quote a senior military intelligence officer who sat down one summer's day in 2002 and read the Annex Bravo, the intelligence part of the war plan, and came in Monday morning with a lot of serious worries, objections, and concerns, and wrote them out and delivered them, and was never invited back to another meeting. So we went into this war with a narrowing base till finally only a few people who weren't necessarily, who certainly weren't experts in the Middle East who really didn't know a lot about some aspects of this were the only people who really knew what was in that plan.
You're the Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent, so I'm assuming that much of this is drawn from your contacts in the military.
Yes, I should emphasize that when I'm speaking here, I'm not talking about my own opinions necessarily, that the book is the reflection of hundreds of interviews with senior officers and a review of about 37,000 pages of documents.
And when Tony Zinni was here not that long ago, I got a number of email messages from people who said, well, this is simply sour grapes. He expressed his opinion, others expressed different opinions, and he lost in the debate, and now he's going around and complaining.
I have a lot of admiration for General Zinni, and I don't think it's sour grapes on his part. As evidence of that, I'd point to the fact that in the 2000 election campaign, General Zinni endorsed the Bush-Cheney ticket. He really thought that they were going to implement policies that he thought were good. One thing I was really struck by in doing the research for the book that I think even now isn't understood is that Zinni, who was the commander of the Central Command, the U.S. military headquarters for the Middle East in the late 90s, was very effective in implementing the policy of containment. And actually, the Desert Fox raids that he conducted were really the end of Iraqi ambitions to make weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein may have thought that his weapon scientists were still working on it, but what we found out after the war through the official interrogations of the scientists was that after Desert Fox, the short, sharp series of cruise missiles and bombing strikes in the late 90s, that they gave up. They basically said, they said that the Americans were never going to allow them to make these weapons.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks of the Washington Post, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And his latest book is called Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, published by the Penguin Press. Your analysis of the lead-up to the war differs from some previous analyses, including that of your colleague at the Washington Post, Bob Woodward. In his book, Plan of Attack, he said that the administration wanted the war from the start, long before 9/11. But you don't agree. When do you think it started?
I think that wanting to invade Iraq was a pipe dream of just a couple of people, Paul Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby. But that was a minority view inside, I think, the Bush administration until 9/11. And it really didn't have a lot of support. If you go back and look at the public record, Colin Powell was talking about smart sanctions, about continuing containment, as Vice President Cheney was during the 2000 election campaign. So Wolfowitz once said to me that he never thought that there would be support for invading Iraq. So what he was talking about was finding support for Iraqi exiles, at least carving out an enclave in parts of Iraq.
So, and you do put a lot of the responsibility on former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz. He now heads the World Bank. Do you think he was named to it because he did such a great job in Iraq?
Well, that wouldn't be part of the pattern of the Bush administration. I think it's an administration in which there hasn't been a lot of accountability for failure and, in fact, almost tends to reward it because they don't like to admit to mistakes.
How did Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, whom you describe as traditional military realists when they were in the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations, transform into neoconservatives like Wolfowitz?
I don't really know. I am not saying that I have all the answers in this book. I think we still are going to find out more in the years to come. I don't understand, because I covered Dick Cheney at the end of his time as Secretary of Defense, and I talked to a lot of people about this, such as Anthony Zinni. And Cheney had seemed part of the kind of the realist school, the realpolitik school. All I can think is that 9/11 really was a personally shocking event for them. Remember, the building in which Rumsfeld was sitting was attacked, that they thought for a time that the White House was going to be attacked. And I think also what we saw from the 9/11 Commission report was there was a consciousness that they had not done as well as they could, that some of the really clear warnings had been ignored, and they were determined not to be caught by surprise again.
When it was justifying the entry into the war, the White House was quite consistent in saying that it acted on the intelligence that it had and wanted to err on the side of caution. Do you think that the leadership genuinely believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction?
I think they do. The puzzlement to me there is no new information had emerged. There was nothing different that said, oh, now we know that's what he has. In fact, after the Desert Fox strike, Saddam Hussein really did clamp down on internal dissent. The CIA had not a single human intelligence asset, they have said, inside Iraq at that point. So it wasn't like anything new had come along. It was simply they were looking at existing information in a different light.
But recently I spoke to a former CIA operative, and he said that if they took the yellow cake line out of the State of the Union address 38 times, it would have been reinstated a 39th time.
I think that's probably
even
right.
So intelligence was, no, some of this stuff is not true, and yet there seemed to be something else going on there.
They knew that a lot of this stuff was not true. It's actually quite shocking if you go back and look at Colin Powell's famous speech to the United Nations a month before we went to war. Almost all of that speech is now known to be utterly false, and even some of it at the time was known inside the intelligence community to be false. There's really a kind of smoking email that came out of that in which a guy at the Defense Intelligence Agency wrote to CIA and said, hey, you know, you're using some false information here. And the senior CIA official pulling together the information for the speech wrote back, look, this war is going to happen. I don't think the powers that be really care about your concerns about one informant.
Is it fair to say that your book tries to shift the terms of the debate away from asking the question, should we have gone to war in Iraq, and towards the question, even if we should have, were we at all prepared for what we were going to face?
I think it's absolutely fair. What I try to do in this book is really look at the occupation itself. My book kind of takes off where some other books have ended, the summer of 2003 into 2004, even to the following years up to the last time I was in Iraq, which was earlier this year, and to look at the occupation itself. How was it carried out? Could it have been done better? Was the insurgency inevitable? Those were the questions I was trying to answer.
Well, weren't they told that an insurgency was inevitable? And didn't the Bush administration have, as an example, something that they should have been thinking about, what happened to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan?
Well, the big difference, they thought, was that we weren't an imperial or colonial power. So it wasn't like the Soviets imposing their will in Afghanistan or the French in Algeria or the French in Indochina or other colonial powers. Their view was that we're going in as liberators. Well, we will be greeted, and we will leave pretty soon. The original war plan called for the U.S. to be down to 30,000 troops in Iraq by late summer 2003. In fact, we're still at 127,000 almost 4 years later.
So what happened? Do you think that the search for weapons of mass destruction prevented the military from doing other things that it should have done, like destroying weapons depots that later were the suppliers of the insurgents?
Well, they really didn't even have enough troops to deal with these huge weapons depots. Some of the arms caches in Iraq are just huge. There was one up northeast of Crete that I was told was 4 miles by 4 miles. That's almost the size of the city of Washington, D.C. They didn't have the troops to guard those, and also the Iraqi army had been dissolved. Now, there would have been leakage if the Iraqi army had been guarding it, but not as much if you had no guards at all. But they didn't blow up a lot of weapons bunkers because they were afraid that there might be biological or chemicals in them. They had been told there will be these weapons there. And so I talked to one Marine battalion commander. I said, why didn't you blow up that stuff? You would have saved some of your troops' lives. And he looked at me and shook his head slowly, and he said, well, I know that now.
Well, if this administration prides itself on toughness against security threats, why has its military in Iraq been so undersupplied and understaffed?
I think across, and I wouldn't just put this on the administration because I don't want to just say the administration was wrong and everybody else was right. But I think there's been a lack of seriousness across the national security establishment, including the U.S. military, about mobilizing for victory in Iraq. I sometimes worry that they'd rather preserve the Army's personnel system than actually win in Iraq. You know, given the choice, let's make sure we keep up this rotation of troops and so on. It's taken a long time to adjust. The U.S. military has adjusted, but I worry also that it's going to be too little too late.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks. His book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, is published by the Penguin Press. Mr. Ricks is the Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent, and he has been covering the U.S. military since 2000. He's been to Iraq how many times?
5 times.
We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Thomas E. Ricks, whose latest book is Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. Mr. Ricks has been with the Washington Post since 2000, and he has been covering the Pentagon in recent years as the Post's senior Pentagon correspondent, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes. Fiasco is what he calls the situation in Iraq, unfortunately. And you make a pretty bold claim, which is that the U.S. military policy in the early months of Iraq essentially created the insurgency.
I think there would have been some resistance, and that was the U.S. military estimate. Their intelligence analysis was that there would be a small insurgency, but that it probably would stop with the killing or capturing of Saddam Hussein. They really thought they would wrap it up in a few months, and in fact, commanders in the summer of 2003, and again that winter, would say to me, "Yeah, we've turned the corner on this thing. We're almost done with it." What happened was that both U.S. military tactics and U.S. civilian policies went a long way towards creating the insurgency.
What role did the American press play in all of this? You argue that the insurgent strategy has been misrepresented in the media as irrational and wild, when actually it was pretty well designed.
Strategically, they played a weak hand pretty well, especially early on. It's striking when you look at it, and this is not just my opinion. I, for example, quote a Marine Colonel, T.X. Hammis, who's quite good on these issues. He said, if you look back at it, they really had a brilliant policy of peeling away our allies. If you look at the real beginning of the real war in August and September 2003, they made the most dangerous place in Iraq to be standing next to an American. So they bombed the Jordanian embassy. They bombed the UN headquarters. They killed a leading Shiite cleric. They bombed six police stations. I remember he said to me, it's a brilliant strategy. Who do you think is the dead ender? And who do you think really understands what they're doing here?
And you quote a number of military officers who make a distinction between tactics and strategy. What is the difference?
There's a huge difference. Strategy is really an almost existential question. Who are we? What are we trying to do? And what means and resources are we trying to use to achieve that goal? Tactics is how you get there. As T.E. Lawrence of Arabia put it, tactics are the stair steps. Strategy is what you climb to get to the top of the stairs.
So has this war been one of tactics without strategy?
Very much. I keep on thinking of a Ferrari without a steering wheel. It'll go fast, but it ain't going to take you where you need to get to. The worst tactic, I think, was in the fall of 2003, the kind of panicky reaction of top U.S. commanders. They didn't have enough troops. They knew they didn't have enough troops, but they saw an insurgency rising, and so they did big cordon and sweep operations where they scarfed up hundreds and tens of thousands of military-age Iraqi males. Now, tactically, this had the effect of making their area of operations quiet, you know, because all the military-age males were gone. Strategically, though, it helped create the insurgency. It took a lot of these guys, maybe the average Ahmeds, kind of neutral fence sitters. It put them into Abu Ghraib. It put them shoulder-to-shoulder with hardcore al-Qaeda guys because we didn't segregate the population. It humiliated them, and they came out probably a whole lot less inclined to listen to the Americans than they went into those prisons.
And even before that, you claim that the forced disbanding by Paul Bremer of the existing Iraqi police force and military forces at the end of the initial combat was a mistake.
Well, that's the parallel thing to the tactical mistakes. The civilian policy mistakes answered another big problem for the insurgency. If you want to go out and create an insurgency, what are the three things you need to do as a leader? You need recruiting, arming, and financing. We didn't have enough troops to seal the borders, so the financing was available from Syria and from the rest of the region, and you could move freely back and forth across those borders. Arming. We didn't have enough troops to guard those giant arms caches we were talking about, so you could go get arms. So that leaves recruiting, and the Americans pitched in by creating a disenfranchised class of leaders, the Ba'athists and the military, and said, here, you have no role in Iraqi society, so what are you going to do now? And they said, well, we'll think we'll fight you.
But isn't that the sort of thing we did in Germany after the defeat of the Nazis, try to weed out the Nazis who had played a leadership role? In some of the former Soviet republics, Soviet leaders generally remained in power, and that had a detrimental effect. So why not do the same thing in Iraq?
Well, it's in how you do it. The Bush administration likes to invoke the occupation of Germany, but apparently didn't study it very carefully. The U.S. Army did study it and actually had written a study of how denazification was carried out in post-war Germany. It was a grassroots thing. It was conducted in each village where interviews were done, records were compiled. In Iraq, by contrast, you had a wholesale declaration that all you people are basically banned from public life. It's a very different approach.
Our press has described the insurgency as largely driven by non-Iraqis and talked about leaky borders. Is the insurgency mostly non-Iraqi?
No. In fact, intelligence officers in Iraq generally will tell you that it's probably no more than 1 to 2% foreigners. That said, suicide bombers do seem to be disproportionately coming from outside Iraq. Yet the people running the suicide bombings, not the people conducting them, but the guy who says, here, go die for your religion, those guys seem to be Iraqis.
Has part of the problem for Americans understanding what's going on been the way the story has been reported?
I think it is part of it. I think there are five basic failures in the entire American system that led to this, and one of them is the failures of journalism. Mainly in the run-up to the war, when some very shoddy reporting about weapons of mass destruction helped drive the stampede toward war. But in Iraq, and I want to be careful here because I have a lot of admiration for reporters in Iraq. It's an enormously difficult situation. It's the most dangerous reporting situation I've ever seen, and I've reported in Somalia, Bosnia, Haiti, and so on. But reporters probably don't understand counterinsurgency theory and doctrine as well as they should. If they did, they'd be even more critical of the U.S. military than they are already.
You tell an interesting story of Special Forces troops having an unusually effective strategy in the town of Ar-Rutba. What did they do, and why hasn't it been tried more often?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't want to be entirely negative. There are some good examples. There are some real heroes out there. I think the hero of the book generally is the average Iraqi civilian just trying to survive, or the average American troop put in an impossible situation. But there have also been some very good leaders in the U.S. military. In Ar-Rutba, you had Major Jim Garavilas, who came in a very different way, in a kind of humble way. He didn't move into the palaces as commanders did elsewhere. He met quietly and talked about Iraqi problems. He wasn't there to transform Iraqi culture. He was there to revive it and to help them and empower them.
And that got a lot of attention, and yet that seems to be the anomaly.
Again and again, the successful commanders haven't been imitated as much as they might. The Army has not wanted to look at its leadership failures. It has not wanted to look at the role that leadership played, say, in creating Abu Ghraib. And so for the same reason, I think it hasn't really studied the big successes very well.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks, whose latest book is Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But the U.S. military has become aware of the need to see its operations as counterinsurgency operations and adjust to the need. How is it adjusted, and how long did it take for them to figure it out?
Well, it has adjusted somewhat. I don't think it has adjusted sufficiently, and I don't think any commander in Iraq would tell you it has. In fact, as one senior guy in Iraq said, one-third of my guys get it. One-third of my guys are trying to get it but really can't, and one-third don't want to get it. They're just here to kick a little insurgency butt. That means two-thirds of your force is more or less ineffective, and that's not good enough. Counterinsurgency is really counterintuitive for anybody who's matured inside the post-Vietnam U.S. military. For example, in counterinsurgency, you want to use the minimal use of force necessary to get the job done, whereas American commanders have been taught to use the overwhelming force, maximum use of force. In counterinsurgency, you treat your prisoners well. You don't treat them as terrorists or traitors. You treat them as people who might be turned, people who might be influenced to come inside the political system.
And that's where we really failed with Abu Ghraib.
Abu Ghraib is a bit of a misnomer because it makes it seem like it was one group of people in one place. One of the real shocks to me in writing the book was the extent of abuse, how widespread it was. It wasn't just these MPs out in this little prison west of Baghdad. It was in a lot of different units, and I think some of the offenses were far worse. There were murders that really weren't examined very closely. And this is part of the Army not wanting to look at how that happened and look at its leadership failures.
You say that equating Saddam with al-Qaeda and 9/11 has, in addition to being incorrect, actually made for an excessively violent mentality among the soldiers.
Yeah, one quote that came out of the 4th Infantry Division, which had a very bad record in its first year in Iraq in terms of murder, abuse, and so on, was they are terrorists and they will be treated as such. What that does, I think, is make you look at the population as, first of all, terrorists, sympathizers, but also as kind of the playing field on which you're going to play, when really the population is the prize. They are the people you really want to treat well. You want to deal with abuse very quickly if they are abused by your troops, because you want to make it clear that you are there to impose the rule of law. You are there to be fair.
There was an op-ed piece by Nicholas Sambanis, who is a professor at Yale, in last Sunday's Times. He said the conflict in Iraq has been transformed from an insurgency into a civil war. There is an article in Harper's called "The Minister of Civil War." He also, in that case, Ken Silverstein, claims that it's no longer an insurgency. So are we adjusted to an insurgency at a time when that's no longer applicable?
That's a good question, and I think we only will know with the passage of time. I think you really have right now both an insurgency and a low-grade civil war. And U.S. policy, I think, quietly is the aim of the mission there is to keep the lid on it and to keep it from pouring over the borders and becoming a regional war.
One of the strengths of your book is your portraits of the main players, their successes and failures. And although we can't get into all of them, perhaps a word or two on some of the key figures: Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, General Tommy Franks, the former commander of the forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the senior military commander during the rise of the insurgency, L. Paul Bremer, and Ahmed Chalabi. You can leave a few out if you wish.
Rumsfeld, forceful personality, I think did not help the war planning, but really he really could have done better is if his personality had enabled him to recognize that insurgency was arising instead of refusing to see that. And I think that really locked up the system, froze the ability to respond to the insurgency.
Was he listening at all to the generals, or did he have such strong views that it didn't matter what they told him?
Ultimately, he had to, because General Abizaid, when he replaced Tommy Franks as his first act, got up and said, and in fact, it isn't a classic guerrilla war, he called it. It's a war, whatever you call it. And at that point, the Secretary of Defense had to admit, okay, it is a war. Tommy Franks, I think history will not treat him kindly for two reasons. First, I think that war plan is going to look worse and worse with the passage of time. Second, Franks left in June 2003, and I have the thought sometimes that he thought an insurgency was going to occur, he said in his memoirs. If that's the case, why did he leave? It's a little bit like Eisenhower in July 44 saying, well, Omar Bradley, I've put you on the shores of France. Good luck on your way to Berlin. I'm going to go play golf. Sanchez, I have a lot of sympathy for Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, top U.S. commander on the ground in Iraq in the first year there. A real American success story. Comes out of the Rio Grande Valley, first member of his family ever to go to college, works his way up through the military to become a lieutenant general, a three-star officer. That said, the consensus among people I interviewed for this book, commanders from Iraq, was that he was a failure and should have been gotten out of there earlier. Paul Bremer, hardworking guy, probably the wrong guy for the job that he was given. I don't want to be entirely negative here. There are some real heroes in this book. Two that come to mind are Lieutenant General David Petraeus and Colonel H.R. McMaster. McMaster I was with earlier this year in Tal Afar in northern Iraq, and it's sort of more vivid in my memory. McMaster took a unit that had been pretty mediocre in its first tour in Iraq, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. He retrained them. It's like he took a football team and turned it into a soccer team. He went to all the units under his command and said, every time you disrespect an Iraqi, you're working for the enemy. That's something that any 20-year-old soldier can understand. Okay, got it. Not going to disrespect them anymore. And he had a very good record of no major abuses occurring during his last tour in Iraq with these guys. He also went to the insurgent leaders in his area, and he said, almost in an apologetic way, when the Americans first came to Iraq, they were like men stumbling around a dark room. But now we have a new Iraqi government. It has turned on the lights, and the time for honorable resistance is over. What you have heard in that statement is the politest possible way of threatening to kill somebody.
But it hasn't changed anything. We're right now, the situation in Lebanon and Israel has got most of the world's attention over the past week or so. But more people have died in Iraq over that time span.
It is startling how chaotic Iraq is now. Every time I've been to Iraq, it has been worse than the previous time I was there. And in January and February, Baghdad felt to me like the pure Hobbesian state. The war of all against all was the way Hobbes defined it.
The administration's general response to many of the criticisms is that it's all Monday morning quarterbacking and that there was just as much of a chance that the strategy would work as fail. How do you react to that?
I think the administration has not addressed what Clausewitz calls the number one duty of the supreme leader, which is to understand the nature of the war in which you are engaged. And because they have not been willing to do that, they've never had a strategic grasp of the situation there.
One interesting trend you note is the growing PowerPointification of military briefings. Could you describe that and why it's had real consequences?
PowerPoint, you know, is this Microsoft way of putting together a briefing that you can put up on a computer, and it's bulleted points. It tends to lack verbs and connecting thought. One of the things I admired most about Colonel H.R. McMaster, his smaller things, but it really pleased me as a writer, he banned PowerPoint in his command. If you wanted to talk to something, if you wanted to make a briefing, you had to write it out in plain, understandable English that had verbs and connective tissue inside it.
Can the United States still win the war in Iraq? And what would winning mean? And is it a war, or is it really at this point an occupation? And so perhaps even the terms might not really be applicable.
I think it definitely is a war. I think it still is winnable, but I think only with major adjustments that would be far more sweeping than anything we've done so far. And that's one reason I wrote this book. I think we could pull this thing off. I got some emails yesterday from officers in Iraq who have been reading the excerpts from my book, Running in the Washington Post. And a couple of them were pretty pessimistic. They said, Tom, you think this thing is still salvageable? And I wrote back to them, yeah, I think it is. But you really would have to operate very differently than we have so far.
Thomas E. Ricks has reported on U.S. military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He's the author of Making the Corps and also A Soldier's Duty. And now, Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq. It is published by the Penguin Press, and my great thanks to you for being with us today.
Thank you.